also had the pleasure of working with in IBM some years ago. Very experienced developer. I'm sure we'll say a lot more about what he's done and what his interests are. But he's going to talk about Android programming tonight. I can see umpteen gadgets on the desk, so I'm sure this is going to be a very technologically savvy talk. And I think we're in for a good evening. Robert has said that he will answer questions, but he will also give us an active demo of the programming before he finishes. And then afterwards, anybody who's in the mood, please come along to Champagne Charlie's wine bar, which is underneath Charing Cross Station. Okay, it's just a short walk along the Strand. And we will then continue the discussion. So, Robert, thank you. Over to you.
Thank you, Jeff. As I said, I was a developer at IBM Hersey on the mainframe KIX transaction server project, and I took early retirement from IBM a few years ago. On the way, I wrote a book about 3270 emulation, which is green screen emulation. I ended up creating a team in Beijing to talk about mainframe activity. So if any of you from distant parts are listening to this talk, ni hao da. Ni hao means hello, and da is a sort of emphasis, very declarative form. And I ended up as an IBM master inventor. I have about 25 patents to my name, and I was about one of 200 worldwide. So I'm a very fairly technical person. So since I left, I've got into Android, and this is my take on Android from a mainframe viewpoint. Specifically KIX, which has done a lot of stuff over the years which have made it into the wider community. So, I do like questions as we go along, and let's see what sort of audience you are. If you ask me a question, I'll be awarding points. And what do points mean?
Prizes.
Thank you. And today's prize is for your browser. It's a cookie. But no ordinary cookie, it's a Waitrose cookie. So, there's a few of these to go around. So please interrupt me as I go along, talk for an hour or so, then do a demo, which is, of course, fraught for activities and desk, but please push off if you need to for trains. So, Android is stateless, open source operating system. Now, that I'm using stateless in the strictly software engineering sense here, that it doesn't save state between instances of things unless you do. You can dump stuff off to disk, but it's stateless. In a similar way, you've got HTTP, which is a stateless protocol. Android is also stateless. So straight away, you've got things to worry about of affinities, and is something I save still there when I come back again? Now, Android runs in lots of places. So you've got your mobile phone. This is running Android 2.3. The latest version for that from HTC. Nice sort of front end screen on it with their famous timer, which I don't really think is very good. Then you go up to the next level one, which is pads. This I got from Maplins for around about £100 in January, running a lower level of Android 2.1. which is a bit annoying because you can't save stuff on your SD card unless you're at 2.2. So you run into memory size problems on these devices. But that's the second phase of Android APIs and things that came in. And then finally, up comes the tablet. This is running the latest release of Honeycomb 3.2. It's the Motorola tablet. Now, there's a conceptual difference between Honeycomb and tablets and the earlier releases. And Google seemed to be, to my mind, slightly changing the emphasis to make stuff fit better on this kind of device. And as I went through creating this talk and heard news about the Microsoft tie-up and the first release of the Microsoft tablet, I became slightly more iffy about Android and where it is for application usage as opposed to data lookup and kind of thing like that. But we'll come to that later on. So 50% of the market, And there are about 800 devices that support Android in one flavor or another. If you publish something to Google Marketplace, it tells you what devices it will support. And there's around about 800 the last time I looked. So it's a growing market. The standard development environment is Eclipse. So it's the Eclipse IDE and all of that kind of stuff. I don't really like Eclipse, mainly because I come from a mainframe background where you get 43 lines on a screen and you type them in and that's it. And you don't get annoying prompts about, oh, here's, I'm going to give you some open quotes. And, no, I know I'm going to close them off, or some squiggly brackets which it puts in, and I'm going to close them off later. Thank you very much. All of that stuff. And when I've been writing code, I've turned most of this stuff off because it's just too annoying. Because I like lots of lines. Because when I was writing IBM mainframe assembler code, you can get so good at it that you just kind of tap away doing what you want to do, and your brain doesn't get involved with it. And you can't do that with Eclipse. That's why I don't like it. But it's a standard environment, and it works quite well in that, and that's what we'll do in an hour's time or so. Now, the critical thing is Android is object-oriented Java. And this straight away produces a problem. And the problem is that an Android app is not a program. A program, you are in control and you do what you want, when you want. None of that with Android. Android is the environment, and every so often it lets you do things. So as it's OO Java, you implement some methods to do things, or you override existing methods to do things. Yes, Joe?
If I can secure the first point,
Yes, go on then.
Doesn't that make an Android app just like a Kix application?
No, it doesn't. It makes it like a Kix Glue exit.
Oh, really?
Yes.
You'll have to explain.
Right, go on, you can have one of those.
No.
Kix is a mainframe transaction processor. You write programs for it. Now, Kix schedules your program and lets you get on with it. But until you decide you actually want Kix to do something for you, you're in control. And one of the things you obviously want to do is to build a presentation for your screen, or you want to read a file or access a database or do something. Android doesn't have any of those capabilities for starters, but it's not a program. You do not get the ability to do what you want when you want. You only get the ability to do something when Android permits you to. So it's a different control paradigm. In a Kix or mainframe environment, the program's in control, and you ask the operating system or Kix or DB2 or message queuing to do something for you. In the Android environment, it's saying, right, well, okay, we're in a method, and the method has been called because you've done something on the screen, cope with it. Now, this is why I say it's more like a mainframe exit, because in Kix terms, transaction processing terms, Kix is a huge, great monolithic thing. Users are executing their programs, their transactions, and you come to want to read a file or something. So Kix gives you the ability to say, oh, before you're actually reading a file, you can do something. After you've read the file, you can do something. Now, and that's not done on the application, it's done as part of the system. That's why it's a Kix Glue exit. Now, strangely enough, one of the mainframe paradigms that IBM's pushing at the moment are these things called events, which can be viewed as side effects. So an application over here does something, triggers an event as a side effect. Application over there does something, triggers a side effect. And you bring them all together and deduce something about your environment. So the common example they give is change of address on a bank account followed by a big withdrawal. That's probably fraud. But the way applications develop, change of address application is sitting over here somewhere, banking application is sitting over there somewhere, you can't change the code, so you trigger a side effect event, bring them together, and deduce something. That's what IBM's pushing at the moment as part of Smart Planet and all that kind of stuff. But the critical thing is that Android apps, you are not in control. And it's a critical design decision. And this is the thing that hit me when I was writing this talk, is the fact that Android apps, you do not have the ability or the freedom to do what you want. You have the ability to respond, and that's it. And it comes. This is why I think that the Microsoft model, if Microsoft's running on a tablet and it's like a Microsoft program, that will be the difference. And that's perhaps why Microsoft on tablets might be better for real application usage than Android. Sir! It's very much like event-driven programming. But the question is, what's an event? Now, you can write program code as part of as event-driven programming, which is very akin to a side effect of state-driven programming. But that's fine for trivial stuff. If you want a real honest-to-goodness proper application which just happens to be running on a tablet for its presentation, and it's running somewhere in the cloud or on a mainframe system, that's different. I like that question. Would you care for some chocolate cookies? So, here's an example from Eclipse of what you have to write for an Android application. And you can see the top bit of the is the source code. And sort of as an approximation, each Java class represents a screen. Very iffy approximation, but it's a good idea for visualization. The next level down are the reses, and you can see that there's three subdirectories, drawable this, drawable that, and drawable the other. And they correspond to this, this, and this. So you have the ability to come up with a different display or different icons depending on what device you're working at. One of the annoying things is that the defaults for everything assume this sort of presentation space. And if you're coming to write text on a screen, you get very, very small text because that's what you assume. Write it on a tablet and it's still the same boringly small size, which makes it look terrible. So they've got these things. You can specify things in pixels or scalable pixels. So the idea is if it's on a small device, it's magnification of 1. On a bigger device, it's magnification n. But I found that doesn't work too well either. So the general idea is the fact that you have a different sort of display layout, which is the next one down, depending on what device type you're running. And by and large, it's the small, the medium, and the big screen size. Yes? Thing, yes. Yes. No, the code is the same. But when you issue your presentation type logic, it will kind of select the default, if that's all you put in. If you actually have filled in these other subdirectories, it will pick the one it thinks is most useful. That's a very good question. Belgium dark talk for you. Thank you very much. And this is the idea that you do get device independence in your code, which is a good thing. And you can see down in the constants thing, these are all definitions of strings. In a similar way you get presentation independence in your code, you can also have code page language independence. The idea is you change some constants in there for another language, and that's it. So depending on the language setting on the device, you'll get the default for your application. And if you suddenly decide you want to support French, and you've got some French things in there, you'll use the French literals. So that's a nice bit of platform independence. Incidentally, it's Unicode, double byte character set, definitions for all this stuff. So it will support Arabic, which is a weird language anyway, and Mandarin in all its various flavors, Korean, Japanese. Menus, the other things are, menus are treated differently. It's a kind of special case. And the most critical one, which it never bothers to tell you about until you need to worry about it, is the manifest file, right down at the bottom. And that is the control logic for your application. And it's critical you get it right. And one of the annoyances about the tools that Android supplies is the fact it's very easy to get it wrong, and it won't tell you you got it wrong, until you try to upload your application to Google Marketplace, where it says, I don't like it, and refuses to say why. And coming from a mainframe background, where every single thing it doesn't like produces a message which you can look up and say what you're supposed to do about it and how you get rid of it, that is amazingly frustrating. Because you're back to the good old-fashioned change it and hope for the best and then change it again and keep going until you finally fix it. So there are imbecilities, delicacies that haven't yet made it. And some of those are down to Eclipse, because that's the way Eclipse works, and some of them are down to the fact that that's the tools that Android supplies haven't kind of got round to doing it yet. Well, I'm sure in time they will migrate. What is really nice, though, is you get, as part of the toolset, an emulator. In other words, you can emulate a real device in your development environment. And by default, it's set to the small one, and you can user configure it to be bigger presentation space or a tablet presentation space. And that's good for two reasons. First of all, it gives you breakpointing and code logic and all that kind of stuff and performance analysis, which you get for free because it's Java in Eclipse. And you can change the screen from that way to that way and see how your application reacts to it. And even if you're a supremely arrogant coder like what I am, and you write it wonderfully, and you test it out, sometimes you get these rather annoying runtime errors. And if you haven't got the development environment set up for the emulator, it doesn't tell you what they are. So when you're developing, you have to use the emulator, because if you try to run it on a real device, and you can just plug a real device in through a USB port and actually run development code on a real device for your presentation. So instead of hitting away on the emulator, you can hit on the real device. Sometimes you just get a runtime error. If you haven't got the debugging and the emulator on, things just stop, doesn't say why. And I have found that some of the runtime errors tend to be more deliberate than accidental. In other words, I mean that you got it wrong, and the development environment, when you do the build of the package, doesn't detect it. So you wait until runtime, which is, again, being an old-fashioned assembler programmer, I hate that. If I can compile it, I don't expect a development-type error. I'm quite happy to have runtime errors or something nasty happen, but not development errors. So you've got to have the development environment set up the debug environment as well. And that all comes for free as part of Eclipse. And that's an example of an app I wrote showing the debugger active for the emulator. So you can see on the left-hand side there's my presentation space. The right-hand side, I'm saying this is a device with a keyboard. And you can see that there's the rows of buttons, the home button, the menu button, the back button. Turn the power on and off. And you've got that little five-way controller thing, which is up, down, left, and right, and all that kind of stuff. So, as part of that, the presentation space is managed by Android. And you've got all the various sort of GUI-type elements of input boxes, literal buttons of all various sites, icons, canvases to draw on, all that kind of stuff. And the critical thing is you enable scrolling. Because by and large, you're going to put more out than you can fit on that presentation space. Less so when you come to the tablet. But Android is set up for vertical scrolling. If you want to do horizontal scrolling, you've actually kind of got to add some stuff in there, which annoys me again, because if it does vertical scrolling by default, why can't it enable horizontal scrolling by default? So you've got to kind of map stuff. So when you do stuff on here, you tend to have manual extra presentation elements to cope with horizontal scrolling. Again, those of you who are familiar with HTML coding and presentation know that until HTML5 came along, it was very, very difficult to actually get things aligned in the place that you expected them to be. depending on the size of the browser window, whether you've got scrolling active, and what sort of various tweaks depending on what browser you're using. So you always tended to end up by resorting to a table and forcing it. So you actually knew what was next to each other and the relationship. A similar sort of thing applies to Android, that even though you've got built-in presentation space artifacts, you do tend to have to resort to using a table to get them aligned in the right order and in the right place that you expect. Because you can change from a small device to a bigger device. You haven't bothered to put any of the extra coding definitions in there to cope with it, so the smaller presentation definitions goes on to the bigger device and it just looks horrible again. And so that's why tables are still quite important. Now, I know they've got around that with HTML5 and all user attributes in there. That hasn't made it into Android. The way you do it is you specify in XML. So it goes into the layout categories here. So you see on this example there are five layouts, five screens, all specified in XML. And here's some examples. I'm sure you'll be amazingly wonderful to read, but basically they show table layouts and definitions of things. And everything starts with Android colon. So you spend a lot of your time typing Android colon in just to satisfy the usual XML namespace rules. So the important thing to talk about here is that each item is tagged with an ID, which you can generate yourself. And when you process that by sort of hitting a button or filling it in, you get returned sometimes the view, as each item is called, but equally importantly, the ID of it. And it's up to you when you write your program to manage those IDs and do what you expect when you're presented with that. Sir! Yes.
One of the fundamental principles of that is that objects do not have an ID system, and yet it appears to design it as bound and necessary to use that.
Absolutely right. It is, and it's to do with their programming paradigm. Each one of those items is called a view, and they're all various subclass down to about five or six levels. But the critical thing is, you don't have any way, when you interact with it, of getting hold of that object and knowing what it is. In other words, the reflection type interface. Okay, it's in Java and you can reflect, but you're going to spend a lot of your time trying to work out what it is and why it's been hit. So they've actually come down to give each one an ID, and it's up to you as a programmer to keep track of them. And when it comes up, this is ID maps to this, and therefore I can do this X, Y, and Z with it. But you are quite right. It is a bastardization of the OO paradigm. But for the practical programmer in me says, yeah, I can understand why they did that.
We'll come back to the relational model.
Indeed. But my background, as I said, is a mainframe. And I was writing code before OO was kind of invented. Even though when you were writing IBM assembler, if you had a good technique, you kind of structured it in an OO fashion, but you didn't have methods and overrides and inheritance and kept calling super all the time. But you could write proper code. And I think this is an inheritance. I'm kind in saying it's inheritance from ancient code. Otherwise, other people might say it's a fiddle to get around a few problems. I leave you to justify it. Have a chocolate. That was a very interesting question. Thank you very much. So the other thing to talk about is the at string. If you have an at in the front of the definition, it means it's defined somewhere else in one of the other files. So where it says at string inb underline go on the right hand side bottom, it says that the text that's going to appear in that bit of the view on the screen is defined as a literal in one of those other files. And therefore, by default, it's English. If you decide you wanted to support German, well, you compile the whole lot again in German. And depending on the device settings, it will automatically pick that up. The other thing I sort of put down there on the same thing is at dimen/something or other. That's a way of scaling for device types, and I said it doesn't kind of work very well. But there you go. And when you go and have a look at this and look at the Android doc, you'll see what gravity means, and I'll come and talk to that slightly briefly. But you end up defining your presentation space with the whole great load of these things all shoved together with Android on, colon on every line. Wrap, for example. There are various three flavours of wrapping. You can wrap inside a field, or you can wrap inside a parent field, or you can wrap inside the screen, and all this kind of stuff. And that's nice. And at the bottom I just said, well, as I said before, it double byte characters out Unicode, so you don't have those sorts of problems. Colour, spelt the American word, to define the colour of things. So, positioning on the screen. Coming from a mainframe background, which has got a nice green screen, which has got 24 lines across and 80 down, I say I want to be at line 5, starting at 24 for 10. Thank you very much. No problem. None of that. For several reasons. First of all is the fact that you don't know what the screen size is when you're writing a program. It can be small, it can be big, or it can be bigger. You don't know whether they're holding it like that, or they're holding it like that. Now, Android development guidelines say make sure you don't force it one way or the other. So that if you have it that way, you get lots of things on there. Reduce your vertical scrolling. If you have it that way, you may not need your horizontal scrolling. But you've still got to write your app to cope with it. Now, the development guidelines say please don't force it one way or the other, except that things are now starting to come out which assume that you're in portrait mode. The BBC News app, for example, the new Times app assumes it. So there's sort of a bit of a breakaway that's saying for usability concerns, we don't care how you're holding it. If you hold it upside down, you're reading it upside down. So there are ways you can force the top left-hand corner. But as I say, the development guidelines say don't do it. But that's another one of these things where Android is evolving away from the mobile telephony space and more into the data space on tablets. So there are two kind of layouts, as they're called. There's linear, which is one after the other, and there's relative, which says, I want this one after that one, which is after that one. And you can expand or contract these are these weight and gravity keywords. But the critical thing is you don't have any control over that. It depends on the presentation space, which again depends on the device, etc., etc. So this is why the emulator is very useful, because you define your emulator to be as many screen sizes as you think appropriate and give it a go. So you kind of start off with a small one, get it working, go to the pad, swap it around a bit, go back to the small one, see it looks all right, and then so make the leap into the tablet. And that's what, talking to people, they tend to do. Very, very different thing from the mainframe computing world where it's fixed. This is all dynamic. So what you tend to do is, as I said earlier, resort to a table layout where you fill cells in, so at least you know where they all are relative to each other. And the table columns and cells can expand or contract if you let them. So if you have a layout of 10 rows, and number 9 is length 50, and all the rest are 10, the top 8 suddenly expand to 50, if you let it. In exactly the same way as the columns can expand, the rows can expand as well. And that's quite nice, because at least you maintain the relative layout, and it's up to the device presentation space, the screen size, to show what you get, which is why you get the horizontal and the vertical scrolling in there, and then you forget about it. What should happen is when you change from portrait to landscape, is you should also maintain the same table structure. Unfortunately, you have to rebuild it. I said it was a stateless OO system. So simply because you define a table and it all looks like that and you swap it over, you might expect it to maintain all the definitions and just spurge them out differently. Hard luck. Rebuild it. So every time they go that, 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 and that, and that, your app is continually sort of zooming around rebuilding stuff. So if you're maintaining a lot of state inside and you're building a lot of stuff which is bigger than the presentation space, you can run into problems. Apart from the fact that you're just doing it too quickly for it to cope, you can get these dreaded situations where the device actually does lock up. And sometimes, if you're lucky, it will say, app not performing properly, and allow you to get out of it. And sometimes it just gives up, and that's the end of it until you reboot. Kix as a transaction server has had 30, 40 years coping with this kind of problem. Android has yet to catch up. So again, if you're having a lot of data, this might be one of the cases where you force it to either be in portrait mode or landscape mode. And if they turn it round, well, it doesn't change. Okay, you manipulate the tables and all the rest of it via API as expected. But unfortunately, some of the APIs are provided don't work, or at any rate don't give you what you expect, until the picture actually makes it to the device. And a classic example of this I've found is when you're building a table, say you've got 100 rows in your table, and you want to show it on the presentation device with number 30 plus or minus 5. So you want to scroll to 30 on the middle of the screen. You cannot do that very easily because the building of the presentation happens in two passes. First of all, it kind of does a measure step for some unknown reason, and then it fills it in. All of which happens after you've built it. Remember I said Android lets you do things at certain times and then it's up to it, so you get the opportunity to build the presentation space, the screen, and then you say, go away and build it, and it may well do it sooner or later, depending on what it thinks like. But the critical thing is you don't have any access to it at that point you're building. So you cannot scroll the table to number 55, because it hasn't been built yet. You can issue the API, and it might well give you a number back, and you might even go issue the API which says scroll to here, but it won't work. And this is why I'm kind of thinking about maybe the Microsoft programming model on the Nokia devices might be better. Certainly there are some restrictions that you have and you've got to cope with. So in the end I wanted to do that and in the end gave up and just said, right, I'll change the background colour and it's up to the user to go down and find it. Which is not what I would call a satisfactory solution, but perhaps there are ways, but on the later versions of Android than I was coding for, you can do it, but I haven't found it yet. One good place to find ask questions is this Stack Overflow website. That seems to be where the developers hang out. So you also have the ability to change things from square corners to round corners and general presentation-y type stuff. And there's another, of course, XML definition for it called shape, whereupon you say what you want the columns and you want the colours and all this kind of stuff to be. And then once you've defined your shape, you just add it in to one of the existing logic or things, as I've shown down there. What's immense fun is you can create your own presentation logic. So was that a question? No. One of the nice things is you can create your own display objects. So what it turns out that all those definitions for edit text, buttons, icons, table rows and all the rest of it are kind of all implemented in the same way through various subclassing, and they implement a few methods. So you're quite at liberty to create your own thing, providing you implement the methods. One of the things I always rather regret not having is the label box. Those of you who are brought up with IBM script, which was a way of doing word processing before word processors came in, you used to have a box with a label on it, sort of a label that came on the top line of the box, and it kind of expanded and the line. So I've been trying to do one of these for my own pleasure and just to see how to make it. And it's sort of getting there. But as I say, you implement these various methods which Android calls. So if you have a wonderful specific something or other that you need, you can have the liberty to create your own specific display object for it. For example, Android supplies built-in ways of doing one and two column lists. If you wanted a five column list, kind of nick the code and a couple of extra columns in there and create it as your own object. So, and then you could bind to it by having an array with five elements in, that kind of stuff. And you can see here that the fact you've got onDraw, which displays it, and onMeasure, which calculates its size. That's an aspect of the two-pass display paradigm. Now, again, as I've said before, apps are not programs. We talked about the fact that they're more like exits. In other words, you get the chance to do something when it lets you. And by and large, you know, it's Java, so you create yourself a few methods, and they get called. And every single one of those methods, you better make sure you call super in it, or else all sorts of strange things happen. Of course, it's OO Java. But critically, you don't get to control things on life cycle. Install and uninstall, you don't get control of. You cannot do saying, oh, I'm reinstalling this app, knock off any previously saved state because I've updated it. None of that. So why, when you're saving state, it might be wise to tag it with the release number of your app, and that when they do an update, reformat it on the first time you get called. You can't reformat it on installation, because you don't have the ability to get in there, but you can only do it when the app's called first time. So what you do is you bung a flag on the disk, which say I've been called once. If that's not there, you do your startup or translate processing, all that kind of stuff. But also interesting is you don't get control of when the screen gets updated. And that's an example of that, was that scrolling thing I talked to you about. There is an API which says force rebuild. So you think, oh, well, that's just what I want. I'll do it now. I'll issue the API, force rebuild, and I expect then, after that's finished, to be able to do the scrolling. No. Read the small print, and it says, we will rebuild the screen sometime, but we're not letting on when. So you can force a screen rebuild, but you don't know when it's going to happen. And therefore, you don't know when it's happening and cannot take action on it. As it's Java, you do get multi-threading support for free. So you can have protect in your methods if you so want to. But as mainframe transaction processing has been doing for 45 years or so, locking and race conditions can quite happily occur between the threads and runaway tasks, which means it keeps a thread keeps running and running and running and running and running and monopolizing the CPU. I gave it a go just to see what would happen, and guess what? The device stopped. So, Android as an operating system environment has got a long way to go before it reaches the maturity of a proper multi-processing transaction environment like Qix. But I would say that anyway, I've only been working on it for 40 odd years or so. There is a restriction that only the main thread can update the screen. So if you're starting a thread off to do something, and it takes ages, for example, accessing a database from afar, issuing an HTTP or SOAP request to some other server, you've got to get back to the main thread somehow to update the screen. So again, your application does look somewhat overcomplicated, depending for those in normal Java or a proper mainframe programming language. There is that restriction there.
So does this mean that you would have a program style, you know, the main group that's updating the screen when you do work in other methods or other threads, you need to set flags that says when it's going for hours?
That's one of the ways. If in a mainframe environment, you'd have a queue of requests waiting to get processed in the main thread, and as it's Java, you can do that. However, because it's on a portable device, you have memory constraints, and you also have CPU constraints. So, for example, if you wanted to rush enough to do a sort, if too many elements get swapped around, it will stop, depending on what else is going on your device at the time. So you can quite happily get it to work in the development environment using the emulator. Oh, yeah, that's right. Oh, well, we'll just give that a go. Oh, no. Error message. Runtime. Not enough memory. So anything that's going to take a long time or use a lot of memory, you should use old-fashioned coding techniques to make sure you don't spend all your time shuffling things around or indexing things. A kind of traditional ancient programming skill is required. Now, this is a picture which I pinched from the development documentation about the life cycle. And the red ones are ones you may or may not need to do something about. As soon as your application gets control of the display space, in other words, it turns up on the screen, just before it will do that, it will call on resume. And if something happens that requires the presentation space, the screen to be taken away from you to give it to somebody else, you get on pause called. So in other words, these are Java methods. The Android control logic says, okay, about to whip the screen away from you, I'm going to tell you that by calling on pause. And if you should have implemented that method to cope with it. It is a state of that diagram. Indeed. Excellent question. Oh, it's also nice talking to you. Giving a wonderfully nice, interesting question. It is stateless, but the critical thing about it is it's stateless at the OO object level. So when certain things happening, which I'm going to talk to you about, your state disappears. Now, in Java terms, what you could do is create yourself an object containing all your saved state, save it away somewhere, and with a bit of luck, when you come back again or you get called again, you can retrieve it. Classic. In here, as you quite rightly say, some of these methods get called and you have lost the state. In particular, if it decides that you're not the top level one, in other words, you're underneath the Z order, and it's running out of memory or resource or something, in which case it will quite happily chop you. In exactly the same way as something called kicks the runaway task interval. It's another example of that. And so when you get called with on pause, you don't quite know it's because something else is coming on top or it's about to do the dirty on you. So you've got to make sure that on pause you actually really do save stuff away that you need to, just in case it's not going to come back again. And you've got to manually reinitiate. Now, the question about whether it's stateless or stateful is a very interesting question, because as an application programmer or system programmer mode, I treat Android as stateless. In other words, I don't trust it. If I think something's happened, I'm going to save all this state away, and if it happens to be around when I come back again, whoopee, but if not, I'm going to recover it anyway. And that's because being an ancient mainframe programmer, I tend to go for the method, a way which I know always will work, and therefore I don't have to worry about it. But it is a problem, and this is why I'm thinking that scaling up to a tablet, when you do have more interesting applications on there, which are going to be stateful or talk to enterprise data, this is where it starts to get a bit frayy and iffy. Now, I'm sure if you talk to an Android developer, they say, okay, you just save your state in the cloud and it comes back again for you fairly automatically, and here's some new APIs to do it. Fine, wonderful. But at the moment, that doesn't appear to be there. But as I say, when I wrote code for IBM, I wrote it the way it was going to work, always. Well, fine, you get the younger types who write 10% fewer lines of code, and sometimes it might not work. Fine, I don't do that. Go with a nice, easy, simple way, and it will be there. But you do have to worry about this, if you're writing something that requires stateful interaction with a server somewhere else, in other words, creates an affinity, you do have to think very hard about the cases when you resume, because it is stateless and it will chop you. I think, well, Android's on pads and it's trying to expand into the enterprise space. This is going to be a potential issue. You can be, yes. But mostly... Indeed. And this is a problem, because I don't think... Because the paradigm for HTTP get, put, read, write access is stateless, but we all know that doesn't work anyway. So SOAP and XML has evolved to cope with it, but that's just a way of specifying a structure with lots and lots of words. Until you actually go to transactional... where I mean unit of work, recoverable resource in the kick sense, you're going to get this problem. And Android, one thing Android is not set up to is to play in an XA transactional environment. And there are no hints that it might just, some APIs might just turn up for it. It just doesn't look like it to me. So Android expanding into the enterprise space, the honeycomb, the release 3 APIs, which do look a lot different from the release 2 ones, playing on the smaller devices, are kind of trying to get you into the enterprise space. But the enterprise space doesn't kind of fit within this paradigm. We in the enterprise space have been doing it for 50 or so years or so. We know how it works. We control it. We rely on certain techniques that IBM and Kix have provided over the years, and they're spread out. Those aren't here on your presentation device. So this is why I kind of think, as I've said before, you know, reading about the Nokia-Microsoft tie-up, if the COM plus C-sharp model and the transactional APIs that come with it turn up in your mobile presentation space, that could cause concern for Android, I think. So we'll have to see how that plays out. But I'm going to be very interested to see if I can get hold of one of these and then start playing about with it, see what a Microsoft implementation is. Because Jim Gray... he used to be at IBM all those years ago, and I remember going in a reading group, and there was a 2,000-page book on transaction theory and logic, which we in the reading group were required to read and understand. And then he decamped off to Microsoft to put transactional support in COM Plus. So, I think he's still there, so who knows? Anyway, that's the life cycle, but the one you're really interested in is on start. And on create, because these are the ones you actually use to actually do the initialization for your application and write all your code in. So these are the basic methods you implement in an app. On create, okay, that's the first one you get called, so you set the layout, you initialize stuff, and you recover your state in it. Now there's this thing called a bundle, which is basically a set of key called values that you create when you change device status. And you do that in the onSave instance state method. If you have a button, you click on something, you get the onClick and the onLongClick. It says that onClick is supposed to be equivalent of the left mouse button, and on long click is the equivalent of the right mouse button. And that seems to be a bit of a movable feast. And the other one you get called is self-destruct. That is when you are going away. And that is your real last chance to do something.
Sorry. Just a question. You talked about, you mentioned that Android doesn't say method state.
Correct. It doesn't save object state either. If you go back to this picture, if you get to on start, sometimes your state variables are not there. In fact, they aren't there. So anything, once you've actually built your display logic, and you've got to the display logic by doing your application business logic stuff, you should always save them away. Now, there's a MySQL database built in there for you to do that. If you want something more transitory, okay, you can put them in the bundle. Problem with the bundle is it's memory implemented, and therefore you're using not very much available memory. But it is a problem. It is stateless programming, and you've got to maintain your own state. Method state, when you exit the method, they disappear anyway. So that's it. But I mean object state, which one would expect in this instance to mean application state, and doesn't. So this is what's in the code. You usually extend activity, and you implement the listeners. Typical Java sort of coding stuff. It doesn't bother to enforce at override or private or public or protected or final. Although, for performance reasons, anything you write, you should usually put final on it for your usual sorts of reasons. You can have your own local methods in there. Fine. Call them with this. Typical Java stuff. The package name is unique in the Google Marketplace. And that's the check that's made when you publish your app. Has anybody else got it before you? So you obviously have your company name and then your thing at the end of it. And it all gets sent out in a signed, self-signed certificate, APK file, which sort of looks like a jar file, because that's what they all do. And there's an example of some methods in there. You can see it's extending activity and implementing things. And the package name is the usual A.B. So I've shown in here that these are methods I've implemented, and it doesn't care less about override and private and all the rest of it. So this is the onCreate one, which is the sort of, this is basically what you do for each application. First of all, you, as it's Java, you call your superclass, and then you set content view, which is your screen, and r.layout is what the tooling builds. And the .by object in blue here is the name of your XML file. So in other words, load the XML file and sort of use it for display purposes. You would then always call get resources, because that's the way of indexing all those things that you created. Why it doesn't pass that in as a parameter on the routine call is beyond me, but there you go, you always do it. Then you recover your state. And I'm being ultra cautious here, so that if it hasn't done something, or if it has done something, it will always work. So the parameter you get called in onCreate is your bundle name. So it's Java, you say, if this bundle name is null, you haven't got any safe state. If it's not null, because it's an object or something, or a handle, I guess, grab hold of the state you've saved in it. Use the sort of key equals value return. Once you've done that, you call your own method to build the screen, which says I call this do build items, which in this case is a two-phase thing. So I do the logic to get hold of it separately from do the logic to display the presentation. A good old-fashioned traditional programming separation of display logic from business logic. Now that's quite difficult to do in Android. But it's a technique I would recommend, and Kix have been talking about this for 30 or so years, and it's kind of stuck. But it's not as easy to separate the concerns in Android as it is for certain mainframe operating systems. And then when you hit the end of the method, that's when Android will build it. What happens next depends on what you do on the screen. So you can exit by hitting the back button, or you can hit a menu by hitting the three menu thing, in which case you will resume in a further method. Which one it is, you don't know. But as I say, if control hasn't been whipped away from you, the state is still around, you don't have to do too much about it. But the programming logic says, well, it might have disappeared. Remember the ID on the object? That's your key. So when you hit a button, or you fill in a text field, or you hit a radio button or something, the ID is your key to your saved state. which is why, classic OO, you don't need it, pragmatically you do. And this is the sort of thing that happens in a long click one. The view is the name of the thing that you clicked, the object you clicked. So you can run various methods on that object, like get hold of what the content is, get text. And then once you've got hold of the text, what do you do with it? In other words, you only get the ability to implement one on long click method per screen. So you have to decide which one was actually clicked and do something with it. One would expect that you can associate one of these per view, but you can't. That's what you do in classic OO mode, hard luck. So then you get hold of the ID and you say, right, this is the one that was clicked, what do I do with it? And in the first case, I'm actually going to show another screen. The bottom case, I'm going to use the API to do something. And in this case, I'm going to access the Toast API because I'm going to copy the contents of the thing I clicked to the clipboard and bung a little message out saying, thing copied to clipboard. So you've got these two sort of conceptual things. You can call another screen, you can access a service. And again, don't forget to put the brakes in there, it's Java, and you get the run through. And control goes back to Android at that point. And then, you know, you may have the screen or you may not have the screen, but you won't come back until you do something. Or Android decides it wants to drop you. Menus are a special case, and there are built-in ways of defining them. They come in two cases. There's the object menu, which I'll show on this one. There's the application menu. Power off, saving down. Thank you very much. There's the menu you get up here with the three horizontal lines. That's the options stroke application menu. So depending on what app's got control of the screen, that's what you get called. The context menu is when you press something on the screen. You can decide you want to put a menu up for it. And there's a definition of one here. And you can see it has an ID in each one of those IDs. When you click the application menu, it brings up this little box at the bottom with the maximum of 6. If you've got more, it will give you a more thing. If you want to show a different screen, you think it will be just an instance of change screen to this, but no. A new screen has its own class. Remember I showed you earlier on there were sort of 8 entries in the Java, and I said one was each screen. Each screen requires its own Java class, and thus its own Java class, its own state. Therefore, you've got to pass stuff across. And more to the point, it's upping the Z order, the stacking of things that can use the presentation space. And the presentation space is on the top one. And the way you go down the stack is you hit the back button on the device. And it usually returns to where you expect. But if Android has done something in the middle to top you or it doesn't like you, you won't come back to where you expect it to. So again, this is another case of making sure you're stateless and don't make assumptions. How do you get that to work? Well, as I say, you're running another class. That can be one of your own in your own application, or you can run somebody else's, sort of like an RPC, or you can run a built-in service, like telephony or database or whatever. And the way you do that is this thing called an intent. Intent will run something else. And it's all mapped to what's in the manifest file. And you can return with data or without data. It's like a link in traditional programming terms. But you may not come back because it may not respond. It may have timed out. Something may have crunched it. And when the intent actually gets run, it changes itself into an activity, which is important when you read the documentation. The key to it all is this manifest file, which contains the resources you require to run your app, such like a physical keyboard, or at any rate a touch screen, and what version it is, so you can go up and up and up. Do you need a camera? Do you need access to internet or whatever? Vital to get right. And here's an example of one. You can see here that there's the minimum Android runtime level, but you can also code to a lower level if you're silly enough to want to do that. And the user's configuration says what sort of device you can support. So if you really require a physical keyboard, you can ask for one. And you won't be able to download from Google Marketplace unless you've got a real physical keyboard. Or if you say you actually want to run on Android 3, because it's a tablet, when you run Google Marketplace on that, you won't see it. And again, other definitions in here define which Java class you want to run and how it kind of works. So if this is only going to be, you're going to provide a service for somebody else to call, in other words, your app is going to get used by somebody else, you have your definitions in here for the activity and how you specify it. And all the things you've got to put in there to make it work. So I've got some examples of that in there. And this is the one where you're providing a service. You can see there's these things called intent filters, where category and data. And you actually specify the data in the format of a URI, such as RAH's wonderful app, colon, something, 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 slash data. And here's the code you do it. Just call start activity or start activity for result. Going to get something back. So again, if it's your own local one, you can use the this and name the class. If you're using somebody else's, you've got to use the full discovery notation. So these are my conclusions. It's significant learning curve, well integrated with Eclipse, development we talked about, the layout is fairly complex and not intuitive at all. Better make sure you get your manifest file right, and if you get it wrong, well, just keep changing it until it turns out all right. It's strangely both alien and familiar, as I've tried to sort of say today. There are lots of good examples on there, and if you try to do something, no doubt find out if you can't do it, other people have complained about it. You can probably reface mainframe applications quite easily on it. But I do have, since I was writing the slides and thinking about it, a concern about whether it's going to win on tablets against Microsoft. Oh dear, 5 minutes late. Sorry about that. Yes, sir. Yes. Yes. No. In fact, you'd be very unwise to try to do anything CPU intensive on one of these boxes, because you will just lock it up. As I said, I tried to sort with only about 500 things in there just to see what I'm doing. You know, it took ages. Strangely enough, the processors on these are a bit slower than either on those or that, and it didn't seem to make all that much difference in elapsed time before it gave up. But what they would say to do that is you run it as a service. So you send your request off to a server or a cloud somewhere other and hope for the best when it comes back.
Would there be any way to write a sample?
No. No, there isn't any intent to do that. And in fact, if you look at the C Java code conversion things, you'll find out because of the way Android calls things and all the rest of it, you can't. It's too much hassle to even try to get it to work in C. Also, the string APIs are different. So you have to stick to the Java development paradigm in that respect. Sir?
IBM technologies, this whole thing seems to be reminiscent of
Yes. I don't know, but there, for an ancient programmer like myself who's seen a lot, there are patterns that repeat, and that's certainly one of them. Also, I mean, for those of you who remember IBM Common User Access kind of thing, that's sort of, you can see the way the presentation logic happens, it's kind of influenced by that. So it's one of these old questions of old-fashioned techniques coming around. And when I was a master inventor at Hursley, all the younger Java, super wonderful, intelligent types would come along and say, look, I've got this wonderful idea, can we patent it? And they were all very upset and said, no, Kix have done this 50 years ago, kind of thing. So these things do come around. And it's up to the maturer members of the community to leverage their experience with the younger ones to stop them getting into those traps. Doesn't that sound terribly old and ancient and horrible? But it is the case that the experienced people have seen most of these problems before and can apply it in this new environment.
Could I say you've been quite critical at times and you're comparing this model with Microsoft itself? Would it be fair to say that most of your criticisms are actually simply a consequence of working within a framework rather than writing a framework?
It's a bit of both. I mean, I'm sufficiently egotistical to think that I don't like frameworks. But frameworks in their environment are good. I just don't happen to think that the framework necessarily meets my expectation. And that expectation is set on an enterprise mainframe transaction processing viewpoint. So I think, fine, if it doesn't really matter, and there's no transactional support there, so you do your update and you prepare to write the code for if it happens twice or it's not there at all or gets lost, fine. I happen to think that in the business enterprise space, these things are taken for granted. And that if people try to just migrate their apps onto portable devices, they're going to have problems. Because the people who understand these new environments don't understand the mainframe environment and its critical security and safety implications, which aren't there at the moment, who knows, on these current devices. Thank you. There's an interesting question. DFH is what Kix modules all start with. And Kix originally came from the Denver programming laboratory before it got swapped to Hursley for PL1. So the rumour has it that D for Denver, H for programming, F for programming group, and H was the next one. There's also another product which uses DFS, which came out from the same place. But nobody really knows. In truth, it's just random. So I decided in egotistical mode I was going to call myself Kix Expert. Then decided CICSEXpert. Probably wouldn't get through terribly any of the filters. So I decided to resort to DFH expert, which had meant things to the Kix programming community.
No.
And I have no experience of the Apple programming logic, mainly because they charge you far too much to get into it. But from what I understand talking to people who do, that Android was developed partly from its phone base, and that's release ones, and then the release twos came to take on the iPhone, and then the release threes are coming to take on the iPads. Now, so therefore I deduce that if Android's not doing it, the iPads aren't doing it. And therefore, in typical rash assumption mode, well, that means iPads aren't good for enterprise applications either. But that's just a weird opinion. So,
are there any
what, sorry?
Virus.
Virai for Android. There has been some discussion that because the apps are self-signed, for all intents and purposes, there is nothing stopping you putting malicious code in there. Because you do actually get a list of permissions in the XML file which says access the internet, allow you to write things here and write things there. So you kind of don't bother to take any notice of that. And once it's in, it's in. So if you put a malicious app on the Google Marketplace, nobody's going to spot it, and this is one of the differences between the Apples who exercise a tighter control. So I was talking to some security lady at the mainframe user group I was at earlier on the week, and we're going to try and put a presentation together about security aspects of Android. And the bottom line is, Android and portable devices are hideously and utterly insecure, and that's for one of the reasons. So again, talking about the enterprise space and running the world on mainframe transactions, you have something like that in there, you just download a malicious app, and that's that. That's a very good question. It's brain the size of the planet. And what thing? Guess what bit of me has never been replaced over all the millennium? Absolutely right. And one of the things that they say they'll notice is the fact that the battery starts to wear out quicker, because it's sending all your stuff over the network. So you may well be detected. I mean, I've got AVG antivirus on those things, and it's supposed to scan the apps as they come down. And how well it works, I don't know. But I would have thought it would be very difficult for AVG to notice an app with a malicious internet send on it somewhere. Who knows? But I have my suspicion. No. There is no guarantee, but there is a presumption, which to my mind means that there's nothing at all. But so there is the ability for you to get chopped while your app's running. And the most trivial case is that you just power off. And there's nothing stopping powering off, preventing your shutdown. So have you got one already? Oh, well, I've got two left. Yes, sir. Any what sort of connection? Garbage collection. One of my pet hates about Java, because you never know when it's going to happen and you have a performance impact on it. Now, there are hints that they have optimized it for portable devices running in a memory-constrained environment, and that's all you get. You don't get any definition of how they do garbage collection or under what instances it starts off. However, they do say that it is bad style to force deletion of objects yourself. But Java always says that. But so I think I would be wary of applications or apps which say we don't need garbage collection or we will minimize it. And my experience of Java garbage collection is it sometimes triggers itself off in a way that can impact your end user performance. And I suspect, because Android assumptions are that you're a user and you don't care what's happening to something else other than you, you can get performance problems on it. And as I say, it's quite easy to generate them by just doing a strange sort. Yes, what do you want? White one or the dark one? Right, one left. Yes, sir. You can actually write it. You can actually write in a variant of C on it if you write native methods. No, because it's not public, and it says please contact the Java team at Google with the implication is we don't want you to do it. Well, what they do allow you is, because you're writing your own methods to implement your own on draws and on canvases, which is what Angry Birds are doing, and at that point you get access to the native methods which are drawing it. So it's unclear whether or not they're running in some sort of version of C, or it's just Java, but it's calling the right things underneath to give good performance.
Well, yes, and because you're then in the world of having to deal with, well, what graphics card have you actually got?
And that's why you then start getting into the device dependency bit in your manifest file. And that, I would suggest, is something that, unless you're a real game developer, you should definitely avoid. But it's an absolutely valid and interesting point. Thank you for raising it. Last one to you then, sir. Take it on the train on the way back over there. Thank you very much. Thank you very much. It's always nice to talk to an audience who knows more about things than you do. And you're certainly it. Thank you very much.